We'll begin with a few articles out of the American Free Press. First one, Representative Ron Paul's Audit the Fed bill had 207 co-sponsors as of June 10th. Paul Martin, who's Dr. Paul's legislative assistant, told American Free Press that the bill is parked in the House Financial Services Committee, chaired by Representative Barney Frank. Martin said the committee's schedule is busy, so he's not sure when that resolution would be debated. Martin said the number of co-sponsors might not automatically force a full House vote, but generally speaking, just 218 House members are needed to pass a bill, and they've already got 207 co-sponsors. To urge more congressmen to support this bill, you can call the House, the Capitol Switchboard, 202-224-3121. And ask for any senator or congressman's office by name. And the committee that's behind this, their website is financialservices.house.gov. Or you can write and then they give an address. My comment, this is one of those issues that seems to be so simple and such a no-brainer that only a politician could invent a reason for not voting for it or being against it. So just for laughs, just for chuckles, you might want to contact your representative and ask them why they're not in favor of auditing the Fed. Next article, also from the American Free Press, and if you like conspiracy theories, you might get off on this one. According to former 31-year IBM employee, the highly publicized mandatory switch from analog to digital television is being done, at least in part, to free up analog frequencies and make room for scanners used to read implantable RFID microchips, which track people and products throughout the world. So while the American people, especially those in Texas and other busy border states, have been inundated with news reports advising them to hurry and get their expensive passports, enhanced driver's license, passport cards, and other chipped identification devices that they're being forced to own, this digital television / RFID connection has been hidden. This is according to Patrick Redman. He's a Canadian. He held a variety of jobs at IBM before retiring, including working in the company's Toronto lab from 1992 to 2007. He's given talks, written a book, and produced a DVD on the aggressive growing use of passive, semi-passive, and active radio frequency ID chips implanted in new clothing, in items such as Gillette Fusion blades, and in countless other products that becomes one's personal belongings. These RFID chips, many of which are small or smaller than the tip of a sharp pencil, also are embedded in all U.S. passports, some medical cards, a growing number of credit and debit cards, and so forth. More than 2 billion of them were sold in 2007. Redman added that chips for following automobile drivers, while the concept is being fought by several states in the U.S. which do not want nationalized chip driver's licenses, it's apparently a done deal in Canada, where license plates have quietly been chipped. Such identification tags can contain work history, education, religion, ethnicity, reproductive history, and actually anything else that they want to put in those. Some 800 hospitals in the U.S. are now chipping their patients. You can turn it down, but they make it available. VeriChip, a major chip maker. The devices are also sometimes called spy chips. It describes its product on its website as follows. About twice the length of a grain of rice, the device is typically implanted above the triceps area of an individual's right arm. Once scanned at the proper frequency, the VeriChip responds with a unique 16-digit number which could then be linked with information about the user held on a database for identity verification, medical records access, and other uses. The insertion procedure is performed under local anesthetic in a physician's office, and once inserted, the chip is invisible to the naked eye. Their blurb closes with, as an implanted device used for identification by a third party, it has generated controversy and debate. The circles keep widening, Redman predicts. Chipping children in order to protect them is being promoted in the media. After that, he believes it will come to chip the military, chip welfare cheats, chip criminals, chip workers who are goofing off, chip pensioners, and then chip everyone else under whatever rationale is cited by government and highly protected corporations that stand to make billions of dollars from this technology. Meanwhile, the concept is marketed by a corporate media that, far from being a watchdog of the surveillance state, is part of it. Nigel Gilbert of the Royal Academy of Engineering said that by 2011, you should be able to go on a Google and find out where someone is at any time, from chips or clothing and cars, cell phones, and inside many people themselves. Next from the American Free Press, the IRS wants only licensed professionals filing taxes. In an astonishing power grab, the Internal Revenue Service wants to license all who prepare returns for taxpayers. IRS Commissioner Douglas Shulman argued that licensing is needed because of the bad guy tax preparers. But of the millions of tax returns filed over the last 3 years, only about 350 preparers were convicted of fraud. This is according to the IRS's own records. Shulman's recommendations could focus on a new model for the regulation of tax return preparers, education and training of return preparers, and enforcement related to return preparer misconduct. Let me interject here. Let's establish a key fact. If the only people that are allowed to make your tax preparations and prepare your tax forms, if the only ones that are allowed to do that are licensed by the government, who's their allegiance to? You, the taxpayer, or the people that are controlling their license, which in effect is controlling their livelihood? So this is a power grab that's really very significant, because a tax preparer who's licensed by the government is not necessarily acting in your best interest. Back to the article. Education and training. Many times over the years, newspapers have sent male and female reporters posing as married couples to IRS offices for, quote, help with their returns. They would offer simple situations, two kids and a mortgage. In an overwhelming majority of cases, four different IRS, quote, professionals would prepare their returns in four entirely different ways. So much for the professionalism of the IRS. Someone phoned and is not on the line now, so I'm going to go on with my commentary, and if you want to call in, the numbers are 265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867. My commentary for today, July 8th. It's common knowledge that liberals waste tax dollars while conservatives save tax dollars, so this statistic might be of interest. Assemblywoman Noreen Evans, Democrat of Santa Rosa, chairwoman of a legislative budget conference committee, ordered up a report last winter ranking which of the state's counties send the most tax money per capita to the Capitol and which ones consume the most in health and other services. The report showed that conservative counties like Modoc, with 49.9% Republican registration, the state's highest, generally consume the most, while liberal counties send in the most. Marin County was number one in contributions. San Francisco was number three. Modoc was number two in consumption, and conservative Tulare was number one. Okay, one hopefully final comment on the glorification of the death of Michael Jackson. Firstly, corporate media, seemingly desperate to have something else to report on other than our failing wars, failing economy, and Obama's failures to keep many of his campaign promises, insists that Jackson was highly influential, even a pivotal figure in contemporary music. Okay, let's look at that. KVMR plays a tremendous range of music. An incredible variety of genres are played each and every week. Arguably some of the finest music in the world. Ask yourself, how many of the genres played on KVMR have been influenced to even in the slightest degree by Michael Jackson's music? I would guess it's about 2%, if that. But the desperate entertainment industry and the corporate media that serves them insists that Jackson and his music are world treasures. The city of Los Angeles, seemingly desperate for publicity or a sense of importance, has had its taxpayers foot the bill for an incredibly expensive funeral procession worthy of Jesus himself. If I were an L.A. County taxpayer, I'd be pissed. The real commentary must be on the desperate need of the American media and public for royalty, nobility, and heroes. Someone, anyone, no matter how flawed. Someone we in our vapidity can worship, if but for a week or so, and not upon the occasion of some triumph of spirit or deed of merit, but upon their death. and so allow me to offer my eulogy to Michael Jackson. He seemed to be a tormented soul during his life. May he now rest in peace. Ho hum. Again, the phone rang, but didn't stay on long. What's the deal? This one is from the Sunday Times of London. Saudis give nod to Israeli raid on Iran. It's by Uzi Mahnami in Tel Aviv and Sarah Baxter in London. The head of Mossad, Israel's overseas intelligence service, has assured Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that Saudi Arabia would turn a blind eye to Israeli jets flying over the kingdom during any future raid on Iran's nuclear sites. Earlier this year, Mehr Dagan, Mossad's director since 2002, held secret talks with Saudi officials to discuss the possibility. The Israeli press has already carried unconfirmed reports that high-ranking officials, including Ehud Olmert, the former prime minister, held meetings with Saudi colleagues. The reports were denied by Saudi officials. Quote, "The Saudis have tacitly agreed to the Israeli Air Force flying through their airspace on a mission which is supposed to be in the common interest of both Israel and Saudi Arabia." This was spoken by a diplomatic source last week. Although the countries have no formal diplomatic relations, an Israeli defense source confirmed that Mossad maintained, quote, "working relations" with the Saudis. John Bolton, the former U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, who recently visited the Gulf, said it was entirely logical for the Israelis to use Saudi airspace. Bolton, who has talked to several Arab leaders, added, quote, "None of them would say anything about it publicly, but they would certainly acquiesce to an overflight if the Israelis didn't trumpet it as a big success," close quote. My comment, how else would the Israelis trumpet it? Back to the article. Arab states would, this Bolton is really a character. He didn't do much as United Nations ambassador, and he sounds like he's doing less now. All right, my opinion. Back to the article. Arab states would condemn a raid when they spoke at the UN, but would be privately relieved to see the threat of an Iranian bomb removed, he said. Referring to the Israeli attack on an alleged Syrian nuclear facility in 2007, Bolton added, quote, "To this day, the Israelis haven't admitted the specifics, but there's one less nuclear facility in Syria." Close quote. Recent developments have underscored concerns about moderate Sunni Arab states, among moderate Sunni Arab states, about the stability of the repressive Shia regime in Tehran, and have increased fears that it may emerge as a belligerent nuclear power. A former head of research in Israeli intelligence said, "The Saudis are very concerned about an Iranian nuclear bomb, even more than the Israelis." My comment, that would be very hard to believe that anybody would be more concerned than the Israelis. And the article concludes with this sentence. The Israeli Air Force has been training for a possible attack on Iran's nuclear site at Natanz in the center of the country and other locations for 4 years. And just to postscript onto this, or piggyback, or however you want to put it, I had a conversation with a good friend, and he claims that he read a newsletter that states that, in fact, when we look at flyovers of Iran, it shows a very small nuclear facility. But if we go back some years previous, next to that facility, which is above ground, they were building a huge facility, and they showed it in various stages, and then it was covered. So, according to this news source, Iran has a much larger facility than is presently seen by satellite because it's underground. And whether they're producing plutonium-grade weaponry or not, we don't know. Caller, you're live on KVMR.
Oh, hi. Getting back to what you're saying about the chips. It gives a new outlook on the old saying, "You got a chip on your shoulder."
Ah, you certainly do. Yes, it's
now you can say it. It's for real.
Yep, the chip has slipped slightly, but now you don't even know you got it. Good point.
Right.
Good
All
point.
Right.
All right. Thanks
Take
for
care.
The come. Thank you. Okay, and of course the thrust of that article was the supposition that the reason for switching from analog to digital TV was to free up the analog bandwidth, so that these chip readers can be more widely used. As more and more people have chips, it's going to require more bandwidth to read them, and you wouldn't want your government to lack bandwidth, would you? This article is from, where is it from? I think it was opednews.com, not certain. It's called The Wall Street White House, How Goldman Sachs and Citi, which is Citibank, Run the Show. It's by Andrew Cockburn. Robert Hormats, vice chairman of Goldman Sachs, is to be installed as Undersecretary of Economics, Business, and Agricultural Affairs. This comes as one more, probably unnecessary, reminder of the total control exercised by Wall Street over the Obama administration's economic and financial policy. He will find plenty of old friends used to making decisions, almost all of them uniformly disastrous for the U.S. and global economy. Amongst the familiar Wall Street faces that Hormats will encounter in his new post will be that of Deputy Secretary of State Jacob Lew, who was lately the chief financial officer of Citigroup Alternative Investment Group, which managed to lose $509 million in the first quarter of last year alone. He's sure to bump into Michael Froman, who also tore a swath through the Citibank balance sheet at the alternative investment shop. They specialized in esoteric investments, such as private highways. But it's now Obama's Deputy National Security Advisor for International Economic Affairs. If Froman is otherwise engaged, Hormats can interface with Froman's deputy, David Lipton, who was until recently running Citi's global country risk management effort. Citigroup is also well represented at Treasury, in the form of Louis Alexander, formerly the bank's chief economist and now counselor to Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner. Given the role played by all of the above in bankrupting us all, Alexander's 2007 verdict on the onset of the mortgage crash, quote, "I think that's not going to spill more broadly into the economy, and so I think we're going to have a normal kind of housing cycle through the middle of the year," close quote, can only have been a recommendation in the eyes of his current employer. Alexander's function at Citi may have been merely to endorse the financial depredations of colleagues with the economic blather, rather than exercise loss-making functions personally. Not so Deputy Treasury Secretary Neil Wolin, who has moved over to the number two job at the department from the Hartford Insurance Company, where he served as president and chief operations officer of the Property and Casualty Group. Hartford was one of the insurance companies that got suckered by the banks into backing their ruinous investments in real estate and other esoterica. But Wolin's treasury has just handed Hartford $3.4 billion of our money in the form of TARP funds. Hormats' agricultural responsibilities will of necessity bring him into frequent contact with the chairman of the Commodities Future Trading Commission, Gary Gensler, a former Goldman partner. As Assistant Secretary of Treasury in the Clinton administration, Gensler played a key role in greasing the skids for the notorious Commodity Futures Modernization Act of 2000, which set the stage for the great credit default swap scam that underpinned the recent bubble and subsequent collapse. News of the appointment did generate threats of obstruction in the Senate. Any one of the senators could have blocked the appointment had they really wished to do so, but such threats proved predictably hollow. Had they been otherwise, Treasury Chief of Staff Mark Patterson could, of course, have lent the expertise he gained as Goldman's lobbyist to overcome the obstacle. For sheer gall, it would be hard to equal the appointment of Gensler, one of the engineers of this catastrophe. But the administration has managed it with the selection of Linda Robertson, formerly a key Enron lobbyist, and intimately involved in pushing through the Commodity Futures Act as chief flack for the Federal Reserve. Prior to joining this crooked energy trading firm, Robertson was an important figure in the Clinton Treasury Department, laterally serving her friend Larry Summers and before him Robert Rubin during their terms as Treasury Secretaries. Such connection to the key enablers of our bankrupt casino helps explain many of the other hires listed above. Michael Froman was chief of staff to Robert Rubin at Treasury before following Rubin to his reward at Citigroup. Most significantly, it was Froman who first introduced Rubin to his Harvard classmate Barack Obama. David Lipton also served in the Rubin Treasury as Deputy Undersecretary for International Affairs. Neil Wolin, on the other hand, appears to have more an allocative Summers, who cherished him as Treasury General Counsel from 99 to 01. Summers and Robertson were similarly close, and certainly he raised no objection to her fatal submission on behalf of her paymasters at Enron. Recent reports suggest that financial industry lobbying in Washington, at $104 million for the first 3 months of 2009, is 8% down on last year. But that's to be expected. Why should Wall Street continue paying top dollar for a wholly owned subsidiary, which, of course, is the U.S. government? That was Andrew Cockburn writing, or at least republished by opednews.com. The time, 12:28 in the p.m., the station, KVMR-FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. The show is Rabble Rousing. Your host is Chamberlain. Next article is by Ralph Nader. It's out of commondreams.org. Ignoring prophetic predictions. I've often wondered why people who go to town meetings held by campaigning politicians rarely ask fundamental questions. Here's one that should have been asked of presidential candidate Barack Obama. Quote, if you get to the White House, will you appoint to top positions Americans who have a track record of making the right decisions in their respective fields? Of course I will, Obama would have undoubtedly replied. Of course he did not when it came to the collapse of the corrupt Wall Street casinos and the bailout of these gamblers by the American people. Obama chose the very Wall Streeters and Wall Street servants who were involved in or condoned or profiteered from the speculative binges that led to the biggest government bailout scheme in world history. The president's explanation is that he wants experienced people who know how Wall Street works. Yeah, right. In reality, he wanted political cover. Something very important is missing when even people who are part of the ruling establishment are ignored, marginalized, or ridiculed, even though their detailed public warnings proved to be all too accurate. Consider billionaire Ross Perot. Back in the 80s and 90s, Ross, as everyone calls him, was right on General Motors, right on NAFTA trade, and right on the federal deficits. In 1984, he joined the board of directors of GM after selling his successful company, EDS, to the auto giant. He could scarcely believe how stodgy, bureaucratic, and insensitive GM executives were in running the company. He tried to shake up the boys at the top to meet the fast-growing competition from Asia and Europe. The GM brass couldn't stand Ross at large, probing up and down the company, so in 1986 they bought out his shares in return for him leaving the board. 2 years later, reflecting on his experience at GM with a reporter from Fortune magazine, Perot called the General Motors system a blanket of fog that keeps people from doing what they know needs to be done. Warming up, Perot continued, one day I made a speech to some senior executives. I said, okay, guys, I'm going to give you the whole code on what's wrong. You don't like your customers. You don't like your dealers. You don't like the people who make your cars. You don't like your stockholders. And to a large extent, you don't like one another. For this company to win, we're going to have to love our customers. We're going to have to stop fretting about dealers who make too much money and hope they make $1 billion a year through us. The guys on the factory floor are the salt of the earth, not mad dog rabid burn the plant down radicals. And all this sniping at one another, the financial guys versus the cars guys, is terribly destructive. GM didn't listen to Ross. Now, after a long, relentless slide, GM is bankrupt, abandoning their workers, 2,000 of their dealers, and their customers' grievances. Moreover, GM is into the U.S. taxpayer for over $70 billion. Perot devoted much of his 1993 published book, Save Your Job, Save Our Country, to NAFTA and trade. Looking back, he was right most of the time. NAFTA cost more U.S. jobs than it created, generated a huge U.S. trade deficit with Mexico, and mainly benefited the 36 businessmen who own Mexico's 39 largest conglomerates, or over half of Mexico's gross national product. The border-located maquiladora factories have high worker turnover and squeeze the laborers in often unsafe conditions for little pay. Here's how Perot described the scene behind the boasting of Washington, D.C., and corporations about the large increase in trade after NAFTA. Quote, most of the goods produced in the maquiladoras are shipped into the U.S. market. Consequently, most of the so-called trade between the U.S. and Mexico is not trade as trade is commonly understood. Rather, it's primarily U.S. companies shipping their own machinery, components, and raw materials across the border into their Mexican factories, and then shipping their finished or semi-finished goods back over to the borders into the U.S. Close quote. A good deal of the U.S. auto industry went south after NAFTA, leaving workers and communities stranded in Michigan and other states. Bankrupt Chrysler is planning to move a modern, award-winning engine plant in Wisconsin to Mexico after receiving billions of dollars in taxpayer bailouts. On Perot's nationally televised deficit warnings, with charts, what more need be said? Even he did not envision what would pile up after his clarion calls. The burden on the next generation and the tax dollars diverted from our country's needs to pay the interest on these trillions of dollars of debt were pointed out again and again, nearly 20 years ago, by the Texas entrepreneur. He even has a website, perotcharts.com, updating the red ink. In Bush and Obama's Washington, there's no room for Perot to gain visibility and recognition. It's one thing for the Washington politicians to ignore prescient progressive commentators like William Grinder, who have been prophetically right on. It is quite another escape from reality to turn their backs on leaders within the business establishment itself. There are many like Perot who must be watching the day's news and saying, "We told you so, but you didn't listen, and then you're not listening now." That's Ralph Nader, writing in CommonDreams.org. The next article is out of the Global Post. It's called Fake News Gets Real. It's by Thomas Mucha. The Daily Show and the Colbert Report target Iran, Iraq, and the rest of the world. It's been a fascinating few weeks for global news, the real kind, of course, but also for the fake stuff. I'm referring to The Daily Show and The Colbert Report, which sent correspondents and producers to locales where comedy shows don't normally operate, Iran and Iraq. Along the way, these two Comedy Central commercial properties cooked up plenty of laughs, but they also produced some insightful and certainly entertaining coverage of these two complex and important global stories. If Wolf Blitzer isn't quaking in his beard, he should be. These foreign forays produced powerful storytelling that illustrate how intelligence and humor, when mixed with a little ground truth, can add depth to very serious matters. It also demonstrates how fake news is, indisputably, a power on the global media stage. As an added bonus, it was yet another funny and scathing attack on the pompous earnestness that typifies much of the mainstream media. You know you're in trouble if you can be so brutally and effortlessly parodied. Let's start with Iran, where The Daily Show began with a simple idea, but then got much more than it was expecting. To cover the country's presidential election, Daily Show host and executive producer John Stewart sent, quote, senior foreign correspondent James Jones and producer Tim Greenberg to Tehran for 2 weeks. The trip followed Jones' last Daily Show piece, End Times, which savaged the New York Times and went viral on the web. Armed with official journalist visas, granted by the Iranian government, Jones and Greenberg traveled to Tehran to tell jokes, but also to poke fun at American conceptions of Iran as, quote, evil. In full parody mode, they titled their series Beyond the Veil, Minarets of Menace, and produced an animated introduction filled with ominous Middle Eastern music and featuring a preening and heroic Jones scampering through the desert. It's the kind of cable TV flash and dash that Anderson Cooper would kill for. Media mocking humor is rampant throughout the reports. There's Jones dressed as the stereotypical foreign correspondent, requisite facial stubble, khaki reporter's vest, and dark sunglasses, a Persian scarf draped roguishly around his neck. There are bumbling interactions with the usual media suspects in Iran, including former Foreign Minister Ibrahim Yazdi, reformist cleric Muhammad Ali Abtai, and Newsweek journalist Mazir Bahari, to whom Jones speaks in Arabic instead of Farsi. There are also street interviews with seething Iranians, where Jones tries and fails to make them say how much they hate America. On the contrary, upon learning of Jones' Daily Show connections, one smiling and stylish young man launches into a killer impersonation of Stewart's staccato George W. Bush. The coup de grace comes when Jones visits a Tehran home complete with a happy and clearly prosperous couple, two bubbly kids, flat-screen TVs, and a Wii game console. "You have a beautiful cave," Jones says, handing the young daughter a carton of Marlboro Reds to earn their trust. Yes, the joke here is on the American audience. Iranians are normal. They wear Dolce and Gabbana and Diesel, play video games, and produce rap music. They know more about American geography and history than many Americans. One elderly man ticks off U.S. presidents in reverse order. Bush, Clinton, Bush the father, Reagan, Carter, Ford, Nixon. Juxtaposed, naturally, with an American Times Square who can't answer the question, name a country in the Middle East that begins with I-R-A-N. The satire is funny. It is also devastatingly effective. But as the events in Tehran darkened, Jones and Greenberg left Iran before the serious violence began, the tone of the coverage changed. A later piece points out that Yazdi, Abtahi, and Bahari, the axis of evil's evil axis of evil, had been detained by authorities. The reports filled with the grainy and visceral YouTube videos culled from Andrew Sullivan or Nico Pitney's running coverage of the uprising. And the final report leaves the humor behind altogether. Quote, as I watch what's happening there now, Jones says, I know that somewhere in that sea of faces are the same people I'd met. People who were gracious enough to take me into their homes and schools and coffee shops. People who indulged my asinine questions. People I hope will be safe and not harmed or arrested for the simple act of wearing green and wanting a voice. Close quote. Do the millions of Americans who watch this series, or more likely internet video clips of it, have a better understanding of what's happening inside Iran? Do they now have a stronger sense of daily life there? Do they now know more about the thing that unite rather than divide the people in these two countries? And did they have fun watching it? Mission accomplished. The Colbert Report, which earlier this month broadcast a week of shows from Saddam Hussein's former Al-Fa Palace in Baghdad, was equally impressive in its foreign coverage, not least for pulling off the technical feat of producing 5 30-minute programs from a war zone 5,200 miles from its studios in Manhattan. So why transplant an entire comedy show into difficult, even dangerous conditions? To correct yet another shortcoming of the mainstream media, of course. Iraq had fallen off of the news map. Here's how Colbert explained it in the June 6th edition of Newsweek, for which he was the magazine's guest editor. Quote, I haven't seen it in the media for quite a while, and when I don't see something, I assume it's vanished forever, like in that terrifying game Peekaboo. We stopped seeing much coverage of the Iraq war back in September when the economy tanked. And I just figured the insurgents were wiped out because they were heavily invested in Lehman Brothers. Funny, of course, but Colbert's Baghdad caper was also smart, courageous, and culturally relevant. The media-savvy President Obama doesn't play along with a dangerous comedian like Colbert unless there's a political upside. Clips of the Baghdad shows quickly flooded YouTube, Hulu, Facebook, Twitter, as well as the mainstream media. The New York Times, Baltimore Sun, Time, Newsweek, and others covered it. And so, like Jones in Iran, Colbert's mission was also accomplished. No, this is not journalism, and neither Colbert nor his Daily Show counterparts make that claim. But in an increasingly global media landscape, where satire bleeds into analysis, and where hope meets the brutality of a Basji baton, fake news is playing an increasingly important role, particularly on the Internet, where hundreds of thousands of people download, watch, and share these clips each day. Love it or hate it, millions of people are paying attention to fake news across America and the world. That was Thomas Mucher writing in the Global Post. The next article is called Fascism Coming to a Court Near You. It's by Tom Hartman. He writes for some of the major newspapers, but it was republished in Smirking Chimp. Corporate Personhood and the Roberts Court. As the 1983 American Heritage Dictionary noted, fascism is, quote, a system of government that exercises a dictatorship of the extreme right, typically through the merging of state and business leadership, together with belligerent nationalism, close quote. Get ready. Last year, a right-wing group put together a 90-minute hit job on Hillary Clinton and wanted to run it on TV stations in strategic states. The Federal Election Commission ruled that the documentary was actually a campaign ad and thus fell under the restrictions on campaign spending of McCain-Feingold, and thus they stopped it from airing. Corporate contributions to campaigns have been banned repeatedly, and in various ways since 1907, when Teddy Roosevelt pushed through the Tillman Act. Citizens United, the right-wing group, sued the Supreme Court with right-wing hitman and former Reagan Solicitor General Ted Olson as their lead lawyer. This new case, Citizens United versus Federal Election Commission, presents the best opportunity for the Roberts Court to use its five-vote majority to totally rewrite the face of politics in America, rolling us back to the pre-1907 era of the robber barons. As Jeffrey Toobin wrote in The New Yorker, no more Mr. Nice Guy, quote, in every major case since he became the nation's 17th Chief Justice, Roberts has sided with the prosecution over the defendant, the state over the condemned, the executive branch over the legislative, and the corporate defendant over the individual plaintiff. Even more than Scalia, who has embodied judicial conservatism during a generation of service on the Supreme Court, Roberts has served the interests and reflected the values of the contemporary Republican Party. And the only way the modern Republican Party can recover their power over the next decade is to immediately clear away all impediments to unrestricted corporate participation in electoral politics. If a corporation likes a politician, they can make sure he or she is elected every time. If they become upset with a politician, they can carpet bomb their district with a few million dollars worth of ads and politically destroy them. And it looks like that's exactly what the Roberts Court is planning. In the Citizens United case, they asked for it to be re-argued in September of this year, going all the way back to the 1980s and re-examining the rationales for Congress to have any power to regulate corporate, quote, free speech. Scalia also quoted at length from an opinion from the 1986 Pacific Gas and Electric Company versus Public Utilities Commonwealth of California case. Quote, the identity of the speaker is not decisive in determining whether speech is protected. Corporations and other associations, like individuals, contribute to the discussion, debate, and the dissemination of information and ideas that the First Amendment seeks to foster. Close quote. Continuing to quote from Polarity Opinion in the Pacific Gas case, Scalia rejected the argument that corporate participation would exert an undue influence on the outcome of a referendum vote, that corporations would drown out other points of view and destroy the confidence of the people in a democratic process. He even quoted an opinion in the Grosjean case, writing that, quote, corporations are guaranteed the freedom of speech and of the press, safeguarded by the due process of law clause of the 14th Amendment. Close quote. The 14th Amendment, which says that no person shall be denied equal protection of the laws, was promulgated after the Civil War to free the slaves. But corporations have long asserted that because it says person rather than natural person, it includes giving. In 1868, when the amendment was ratified into law, full constitutional rights under the Bill of Rights to corporations. Corporations are, at law, known as artificial persons and humans as natural persons. Both have to have some sort of personhood in order to pay taxes, sue, and be sued, etc. Bottom line, corporate free speech rights are real rights that must be respected. The attempt of corporations and their lawyers, like Roberts, was before ascending to a federal... The attempt of corporations and their lawyers, like Roberts was before ascending to the federal court, to usurp American democracy. And it's nothing new, as dissenting Justice David Souter well knew. Fascism has always been a threat to democracy. In early 1944, the New York Times asked Vice President Wallace to, as Wallace noted, write a piece answering the following questions. What is a fascist? How many fascists have we? How dangerous are they? Vice President Wallace's answers to those questions were published in the New York Times on April 9, 1944, at the height of the war against the Axis powers of Germany and Japan. Quote, the really dangerous American fascists, Wallace wrote, are not those who are hooked up directly or indirectly with the Axis. The FBI has its finger on those. The FBI has its finger on those. With a fascist, the problem is never how best to present the truth to the public, but how best to use the news to deceive the public into giving the fascist and his group more power or more money. American fascism will not be really dangerous, he added in the next paragraph, until there's a purposeful coalition amongst the cartelists, the deliberate poisoners of public information. Noting that fascism is a worldwide disease, Wallace further suggested that fascism's greatest threat to the United States will come after the war and will manifest within the United States itself. In his strongest indictment of the tide of fascism, the Vice President of the United States saw rising in America. He added, "They claim to be super patriots, but they would destroy every liberty guaranteed by the Constitution. They demand free enterprise, but are the spokesmen for monopoly and vested interests. Their final objective, towards which all their deceit is directed, is to capture political power, so that using the power of the state and the power of the markets simultaneously, they can keep the common man in eternal subjugation." This was spoken in 1944. Look where we are now. Finally, Wallace said, the myth of fascist efficiency has deluded many people. Democracy, to crush fascism internally, must develop the ability to keep people fully employed and at the same time balance the budget. It must put human beings first and dollars second. It must appeal to reason and decency and not to violence and deceit. We must not tolerate oppressive government or industrial oligarchy in the form of monopolies and cartels. As Wallace's president, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, said when he accepted his party's renomination in 1936, out of this modern civilization, economic royalists have carved new dynasties. It was natural and perhaps human that the privileged princes of these new economic dynasties, thirsting for power, reached out for control over government itself. They created a new despotism and wrapped it in the robes of legal sanction. And as a result, the average man once more confronts the problem that faced the Minuteman. Speaking indirectly of the fascists that Wallace would directly name almost a decade later, Roosevelt brought the issue to its core. Quote, "These economic royalists complain that we seek to overthrow the institutions of America. What they really complain of is that we seek to take away their power." But he thundered in that speech, "Our allegiance to American institutions requires the overthrow of this kind of power." In just a few months, we may again stand in the same crossroads Roosevelt and Wallace confronted during the Great Depression and World War II. Fascism is rising in America, this time calling itself compassionate conservatism and the free market in a flat world. The point of its spear is corporate personhood and corporate free speech rights. The Roberts Court's behavior, if this prediction of their goal for this fall is accurate, and it's hard to draw any other conclusion, now eerily parallels the day in 1936 when Roosevelt said, quote, "In vain they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution. In their blindness they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for." Close quote. The phone was ringing. It's not now. I'll go on to the next article. Oh, there it is. Caller, you're live on the air.
Hi, John Burr, Ross from Sacramento. How are you doing today?
Yep.
Great show. On your comment about the analog stations going off the broadcast network and being used for RITIDs,
right.
I'm one of the people that had analog and never had digital. I've just let it lapse.
Okay.
So I don't miss it, but I go back to the analog just to check it out every once in a while.
Okay.
There are still 8 stations. 7 stations broadcasting.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on the analog station. Like Channel 8 is Chinese news.
Oh.
Channel 15 is Spanish videos.
Okay.
23 is the Home Shopping Network.
Okay, we can't do without that.
Exactly, can't do without that. 32 is Spanish telenovelas.
Okay.
33 is Spanish soccer. In fact, these are coming in better now than before.
Well, that's not surprising because there's less interference.
I'm probably getting them from Dr. Modesto, maybe, or something like that. But
okay.
33 is great to watch the international soccer. I watched Manchester United and who was it? Barcelona.
Okay.
45 is 700 Club. Again, can't do without that.
Right.
Pairing with Home Shopping Network. And 49 is some kind of homeless animal advocacy station.
Hmm.
They had Southern California surfing dogs. And was
okay.
Advocating people to call in and give money to the homeless animal shelter.
Okay.
Just to give you up to date on what's on the analog airways.
So the analog still exists.
Analog
interesting.
Still exists, and it's actually pretty good as far as soccer's concerned. I'm
okay.
Happy.
Okay. Thanks for the update.
You're welcome. Bye bye, Chava.
Bye bye. Caller, it's your turn. You're live on KVMR.
Excellent. Yeah, on Friday on Democracy Now!, they had a speech by Noam Chomsky called Hope in Crisis, and it mentions, too, about a book Aaron Bowdy Roy is coming out with about how democracy may be the end game of free civilization, and it's kind of it's freezing of the process of government once big corporations come in and start their lobbying effort, like with the healthcare initiative and things like that.
Yeah, we're watching it right in front of us.
Yeah, exactly, and how 60-70% of the people want healthcare and want, you know, a more sane drug policy, but the people who have the vested interest in it, just the same as nuclear weapons, they don't really care about it.
No, you know what? Screw them.
Yeah, it's the same with it's the scary thing. It's like when McNamara died, they mentioned how many American soldiers were killed, upwards of 50,000, but rarely did they mention the over 3 million Vietnamese who were sacrificed towards whatever the best and the brightest thought they were.
Hey, look, get it straight. First of all, they're not white, and second of all, they don't vote.
Exactly.
That's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call. Okay, one of my favorite blogsters is Fred Reed. Let me read you something by him. The Mexican War of 1847 didn't protect our freedoms. In the view of Ulysses Grant, a participant in that war, and unconvincing as a limp-wristed liberal, it constituted sheer, unjustified aggression. In the Civil War, the Confederacy posed no danger to our freedoms, if by us means the Union. The South wanted only to be left alone to misbehave in peace. The Spanish-American War of 1898 was also unjustified aggression. Neither Cuba nor Spain posed the slightest threat to our freedoms. World War I didn't protect our freedoms, nor probably those of Europe. It was an internal war between colonial powers led by idiots. World War II was justified retaliation for attack and a plausible long-term peril for freedom. The Korean War wasn't about our freedoms. Many observers assert that it actually took place in Korea, and neither was Vietnam. We lost the latter and seem no less free than before. Iraq has nothing to do with our freedoms. It couldn't threaten the freedom of Guatemala. So anybody that's claiming that those previous wars were fighting for our freedoms, it's 1-for-8. And he's speaking actually to Ralph Peters, who was a representative of the American Legion. Ralph, a doubtless well-paid commentator on television, complains that our elites do not fight in the country's wars. That's true. Neither do our Ralphs. Relying on his biography in Wikipedia, I find that he was born in 52, making of military age in 1970. The war in Vietnam being at its height, he went to Europe for 10 years. Rough duty, it was. Cirrhosis always looms in those beer gardens. He retired from the Army as a lieutenant colonel in intelligence. In the Marines, we referred to such people as REMFs, rear echelon MFs. I'll leave listeners to figure out what MF refers to. I confess to a loathing for those who shelter safely behind the lines, yet send others to fight. Bow, gruff, woof. Still, his record's not irrelevant to his views. War looks exciting to office workers, but has less appeal to those who are forced to fight. It has even less appeal to those who are hurt. Don't take this as a denigration of Ralph, though intelligence work carries its perils. He could have broken a nail on a shift key. Sure, a trip to the nails parlor would fix it, but those things hurt. Ralph, of course, speaks of the sacrifices our boys are making. They aren't making sacrifices, they're being sacrificed. Sacrifices are voluntary, but if the troops decline to fight, they go to jail. The mechanics go this way. Having an all-volunteer army minimizes objections to the war, since no one of any influence has to go. If a lot of high school grads from Tennessee are getting killed, well, it's not a good thing, of course, but who really cares? This facilitates hobbyist wars. A voluntary army is a small army, so you have to send the same troops for tour after tour until they're half-man and their family's wrecked. Who cares? They're just rednecks anyway, not our sort of people. Nobody a general would let his daughter date. What are the current wars about? Ralph thinks, or says he thinks, that our wars serve to protect civilization, decency, and apple pie. This is either boilerplate brainlessness or deliberate cant. Permit me to cite a contrary view. War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easiest, most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to be to the majority of the people. Only a small inside group knows what it's about. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few at the expense of the very many. Out of war, a few people make huge profits. Many will recognize this as the writing of the celebrated leftist Noam Chomsky, but this would be a case of misidentification. The author is, of course, Marine Major General Smedley Butler, holder of 2 Congressional Medals of Honor, even more than Ralph. But what does Butler know about war compared to an officer weenie veteran of Europe's beer halls? War is a racket. The military budget is absolutely huge, and after you add up the usual budget, the expenditures for the current wars, the intelligence outfits, the black programs, the Veterans Administration, and Homeland Security, each of these jelly jars attracts its swarm of hungry bees. Always a new weapon is needed. Some threat palpitates in the darkness, ready to defeat the weapons we have. Some of these programs become virtual kingdoms. A fighter can take a quarter century to develop at wonderful cost. Then you get to produce it for decades, perhaps, and sell spare parts and upgrades, and then when it's obsolete, you sell it to other countries and supply them with parts and upgrades, seemingly forever. Money, money, money. An occasional war provides plausibility. Of course we're in Iraq to protect our freedoms, Ralph. Who could doubt it? Only by coincidence does colonization put American troops on the borders of Iran and Syria, enemies of Israel, and in a position to control by intimidation the oil of Iran, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Iraq, and the United Arab Emirates. Coincidence, I assure you. A bloated military requires enemies, Ralph. Sees one in the Mohammedans. A desperate recourse, but the only one available. Enemies have to be frightening so as to justify the budget. The Soviets were serviceable in this regard, having a huge, if low-grade, military and a history of occupying places. When the commies punked out, no believable bugaboo was at hand, so makeup was applied to Muslims to let them serve until China came on.